we start something new. What we have come to call the Yoga of Divine Love. Of course, when Sri Aurobindo was bringing forth the Arya month after month, this was a continuing series on the synthesis of yoga, and he had no such demarcation. This first essay about the Yoga of Divine Love appeared on the 15th of April in 1918. So rather than go through a lengthy historical analysis of bhakti yoga now, I think we'll do it a little at a time as we work our way through these number of essays. Chapter 1, Love and the Triple Path. Will, knowledge, and love. Are the three divine powers in human nature and the life of man? And they point to the three paths by which the human soul rises to the divine. The integrality of them, the union of man with God in all the three, must therefore, as we have seen, be the foundation of an integral yoga. So, you know how close he was to the Bhagavad Gita and what we have come to call Tri Marga, which is not an expression that occurs within the Gita, but the three paths defined there: works, knowledge, and love. He takes up severally, one after the other. And like Swami Vivekananda, when he was marshaling all the tradition of India and its yogic practice, brought in a fourth element. For him, it was Raja Yoga, the king of yogas. For Sri Aurobindo, it's something entirely different. He brings forward, beyond these three, the fourth as the yoga of self-perfection, something that was shown to him from within when he was first perhaps arriving in Pondicherry. Perhaps was vouchsafed to him, at least in its first visioning, before he ever reached Pondicherry. But surely he worked out the scheme of what would be the fulfillment of yoga in all the strands of the being, all these three, love, knowledge, and works unified as a step beyond the fulfillment of any single one of these, and as a consummation, having perfected all the other three first. Or at least consequent with each other. So, the tradition of yoga, as you know, goes back as late in our times as the Upanishads. We really don't find yoga appearing in the Veda. We see it in some of the Upanishads, and then, of course, we get the great articulation of it in the Mahabharata, in more than one place. Of course, the one that's most famous now is the treatment of yoga in the Bhagavad Gita. But in the Upanishads, certainly, we have it spoken of substantially in the Shvetashvatara Upanishad, in the Katha Upanishad, in the Mundaka Upanishad. And some of it, especially Shvetashvatara, seems in a sense to be a prelude to what appears in the Gita. It isn't that the yoga of divine love appears only in the Gita. It is adumbrated in the Shvetashvatara Upanishad, surely. We also find it in elemental strength in the early development of Shaivism and Vaishnavism. And who knows which came first? Also, devotion to the Divine Mother, to the Mahashakti. Something was awakening in the human heart roughly 500 BCE to now. Not simply the effortful attempt to reestablish a fragmented being into some sort of consummating communion with the Supreme Being, a final surpassing existence, but something that rendered itself delightful and full of relational possibilities throughout the emotional and affective being. But for Sri Aurobindo, the practice of yoga centered on the experience of oneness. Always, whether it is in the mind or in consummating action or in the depths of the heart, it is an identity, a communion of the aspiring spirit with that which it seeks, a fusion, a merger, no division, completeness of being. Action is the first power of life. Nature begins with force and its works, which, once conscious in man, become will and its achievements. Therefore it is that by turning his action Godwards, the life of man best and most surely begins to become divine. It is the door of first access, the starting point of the initiation. When the will in him is made one with the divine will, and the whole action of the being proceeds from the divine and is directed towards the divine, the union in works is perfectly accomplished. But works fulfill themselves in knowledge. All the totality of works, says the Gita, finds its rounded culmination in knowledge. Sarvam karma kilam jnane parisamapyate. By union in will and works, we become one in the omnipresent conscious being from whom all our will and works have their rise and draw their power, and in whom they fulfill the round of their energies. And the crown of this union is love, for love is the delight of conscious union with the being in whom we live, act, and move, by whom we exist, for whom alone we learn in the end to act and to be. That is the trinity of our powers, the union of all three in God, to which we arrive when we start from works as our way of access and our line of contact. So in this paragraph, he's begun with the power of works to unite us with the divine, and then talked about knowledge, and then culminated in love. Interesting, is it not, that this is the order of succession also in the Bhagavad Gita? The quotation there in Sanskrit is from the Gita, chapter 4, the 33rd shloka, and translates as, all action ends in knowledge. That last sentence, this is the trinity of our powers, the union of all three in God, again, suggests to us that we are being restored to the full being of the infinite, prior to, but including, the comprehensive manifestation of the universe and every creature in it. This is Satchit Ananda, on infinite display, held infinitely within, and thrown infinitely out into manifestation. If we can talk for a moment about the Gita, I just did a quick count. It looks to me like there are 116 shlokas in which the term karma appears. There are about 55 shlokas in which the term jnana appears. There are about 33 shlokas in which the term bhakti appears. But it is the culmination which Sri Krishna, as Purushottama, offers to Arjuna. First, you do your perfection and works. Then you come to know me and all the principles and ways of my being. And then you step into my very nature, Madbhavam. And there, knowledge and works and love become one. It is identity. That great spirit that issued you forth has managed to bring you back, rising out of all the integuments of nature and how it might bind. Knowledge is the foundation of a constant living in the divine. For consciousness is the foundation of all living and being, and knowledge is the action of the consciousness, the light by which it knows itself and its realities, the power by which, starting from action, we are able to hold the inner results of thought and act in a firm growth of our conscious being until it accomplishes itself by union in the infinity of the divine being. The divine meets us in many aspects, and to each of them, knowledge is the key, so that by knowledge we enter into and possess the infinite and divine in every way of his being, sarva bhavena, and receive him into us and are possessed by him in every way of ours. So that is a term taken from the Gita, chapter 15, verse 19. Without knowledge, we live blindly in him with the blindness of the power of nature intent on its works, but forgetful of its source and possessor, undivinely, therefore, deprived of the real, the full delight of our being. So when we're blind, we become ignorant. We ignore our source. And we ignore our source, we have partiality of being, and we can suffer. Suffer from by division, suffer from separation. By knowledge, arriving at conscious oneness, ekatvam, with that which we know, for by identity alone can complete and real knowledge exist, the division is healed, and the cause of all our limitation and discord and weakness and discontent is abolished. But knowledge is not complete without works. For the will in being also is God, and not the being or its self-aware silent existence alone. And if works find their culmination in knowledge, knowledge also finds its fulfillment in works. And here too, love is the crown of knowledge. For love is the delight of union, and unity must be conscious of joy of union to find all the riches of its own delight. Perfect knowledge indeed leads to perfect love, integral knowledge to a rounded and multitudinous richness of love. Quote, "He who knows me," says the Gita, "as the Supreme Purusha, not only as the immutable oneness, but in the many-souled movement of the divine, and as that superior to both, in which both are divinely held, he, because he has the integral knowledge, seeks me by love in every way of his being. This is the trinity of our powers, the union of all three in God, to which we arrive when we start from knowledge." So treating knowledge as the opening path, ekatvena, with oneness, vishvato mokam, facing in all directions, we find that single divine being. You can go to Gita 9:15 and also to Gita 11:54, tatvena jnatum, known in the true nature. One knows the Supreme Person, janati purushottam, and knows all, and worships him with his whole being. Janati purushottam sa sarvavid bhajati mam sarva bhavina. That again is 15:19. So this idea of the wholeness of the divine being known in all the many ways of its working, not simply in the essence, yes, the essence, absolutely, but in all the ways that it deploys itself, and then to unite all those deployings in oneself to the all in all and to the one in all. You see, this is the beauty of the experience of a fulfilling integral yoga that Sri Aurobindo describes here. And then he goes on. Love is the crown of all being and its way of fulfillment, that by which it rises to all intensity and all fullness and the ecstasy of utter self-finding. If we can remark on the Gita yet again, Krishna leads Arjuna, a step at a time, first in the fulfillment of desireless work, where he can forget his ego and let the divine will work through him impartially, and then into a deep knowledge of the divine essentially and in all the ways of these that we see in the world. And finally, he can take Arjuna, because he has been impersonalized, he's been enlarged, he's been made one with the nature of the Supreme, into the experience of love without the flaws of sin and mentality, without the small jealousies and partialities that often accompany the human experience. So Krishna first makes Arjuna capable by making him great in works, by growing him in his spiritual stature, and then invites him into the culminating experience of a universal love, into utter oneness, into bliss itself. So let's read that sentence again. Love is the crown of all being and its way of fulfillment, that by which it rises to all intensity and all fullness and the ecstasy of utter self-finding. For if the being is in its very nature consciousness, and by consciousness we become one with it, therefore by perfect knowledge of it fulfilled in identity, yet is delight the nature of consciousness, and of the acme of delight, love is the key and the secret. And if will is the power of conscious being, by which it fulfills itself And by union in will, we become one with the being and its characteristic infinite power. Yet all the works of that power start from delight, live in the delight, have delight for their aim and end. Love of the being in itself and in all of itself, that its power of consciousness manifests, is the way to the perfect wideness of the Ananda. Well, this is an obvious allusion to the Taittiriya Upanishad. This is would be in chapter 3, the 6th verse. All things rise from delight, all things are sustained in delight, and into delight all things go and they're passing hence. The Taittiriya Upanishad must be the seed of what later, hundreds and hundreds of years later, maybe 1,000 years later, gets articulated in theistic Vedanta as Satchit-Ananda, which was never an impersonal being, but always a personal being with an infinite consciousness whose nature is bliss. Love is the power and passion of the divine self-delight. And without love, we may get the rapt peace of its infinity, the absorbed silence of the Ananda, but not its absolute depth of richness and fullness. Love leads us from the suffering of division into the bliss of perfect union, but without losing that joy of the act of union, which is the soul's greatest discovery, and for which the life of the cosmos is a long preparation. Therefore, to approach God by love is to prepare oneself for the greatest possible spiritual fulfillment. And remember that in the Gita, the Purushottama, the Supreme Person, is described as manifesting through his own supreme nature, para-prakriti. All things are sparks of his own being flying out into manifest existence in our universe and in the conscious universe, inner and outer. Love leads us from the suffering of division into the bliss of perfect union. So Sri Aurobindo has again stepped away from the prepossessions of Buddhism and preferred the idea that this whole cosmos is a long drama leading the soul through hide and seek and self-seeking and finally self-finding in the Supreme Being of perfect delight. So the universe is staged in just this way, that we grow gradually out of darkness to light. From non-being into true being. From what seems to be death to immortality, from suffering to bliss. Love fulfilled does not exclude knowledge, but itself brings knowledge. And the completer the knowledge, the richer the possibility of love. By bhakti, says the Lord in the Gita, shall a man know me in all my extent and greatness, and as I am in the principles of my being. And when he has known me in the principles of my being, then he enters into me. This is Gita chapter 11, verses 54 and 5. Love without knowledge is a passionate and intense, but blind, crude, often dangerous thing. A great power, but also a stumbling block. Love, limited in knowledge, condemns itself in its fervor, and often by its very fervor, to narrowness. But love, leading to perfect knowledge, brings the infinite and absolute union. Such love is not inconsistent with, but rather throws itself with joy into divine works, for it loves God and is one with him in all his being, and therefore in all beings. And to work for the world is then to feel and fulfill multitudinously one's love for God. This is the secret behind Loka Sangraha. You may begin to work for the world, in service to the world, but it has to be for the holding together of the worlds, not just the human people, but the holding together of the worlds. And why would you do that? Because you're bonded with them. Bhakti, devotion, is a word that comes from bhaj, which means to attach to share, to apportion. When you feel that the whole universe has been apportioned out of this one being and you're connected with it all, then you are constantly in service to all of it. Love without knowledge is a passionate and intense, but blind, crude, often dangerous thing. A great power, but also a stumbling block. Love, limited in knowledge, condemns itself in its fervor, and often by its very fervor to narrowness. We can escape that by this enlargement. But love, leading to perfect knowledge, brings the infinite absolute union. So knowledge perfected with perfected works leads to perfected love, the largest possible love. Such love is not inconsistent with, but rather throws itself with joy into divine works. For it loves God and is one with him in all his being, therefore in all beings. And to work for the world is then to feel and fulfill multitudinously one's love for God. It's worth reading again. This sustained Sri Aurobindo through his many decades of yoga. As he said, had that experience of ananda and love at the very basis of his sadhana, he could not have continued. It would have been set down as a theory in the teens of the century. This is the trinity of our powers, the union of all three in God, to which we arrive when we start on our journey by the path of devotion with love for the angel of the way, to find in the ecstasy of the divine delight of the all-lover's being the fulfillment of ours, its secure home and blissful abiding place, and the center of its universal radiation. So by loving the divine in all beings and serving that omnipresent soul, we open ourselves to that. Since then, in the union of these three powers, lies our base of perfection. The seeker of an integral self-fulfillment in the divine must avoid or throw away, if he has them at all, the misunderstanding and mutual depreciation which we often find existent between the followers of the three paths. Those who have the cult of knowledge seem often, if not to despise, yet to look downward from their dizzy eminence on the path of the devotee as if it were a thing inferior, ignorant, good only for souls that are not yet ready for the heights of the truth. It is true that devotion without knowledge is often a thing raw, crude, blind, and dangerous, as the errors, crimes, follies of the religious have too often shown. But this is because devotion in them has not found its own path, its own real principle, and has not therefore really entered on the path, but is fumbling and feeling after it, is on one of the bypaths that lead to it. And knowledge, too, at this stage, is as imperfect as devotion. Dogmatic, schismatic, intolerant, bound up in the narrowness of some single and exclusive principle, even that being usually very imperfectly seized. When the devotee has grasped the power that shall raise him, he has really laid hold on love, that in the end purifies and enlarges him as effectively as knowledge can. They are equal powers, though their methods of arriving at the same goal are different. The pride of the philosopher looking down on the passion of the devotee arises, as does all pride, from a certain deficiency of his nature. For the intellect, too exclusively developed, misses what the heart has to offer. The intellect is not in every way superior to the heart. If it opens more readily doors at which the heart is apt to fumble in vain, it is itself apt to miss truths which to the heart are very near and easy to hold. And if, when the way of thought deepens into spiritual experience, it arrives readily at the ethereal heights, pinnacles, skyey widenesses, it cannot, without the aid of the heart, fathom the intense and rich abysses and oceanic depths of the divine being and the divine Ananda. I refer you to the Gita, chapter 18, shloka 65. But here at the end, Sri Aurobindo is contrasting the experience of the Atman, of the spiritual consciousness, that universality of being. There would be no need for a universe if there were not that transcendent seed planted in the psychic, which then conveys itself through all the cosmic tumult to arrive at the grandest possible harmony. And that psychic being is the seed of delight, of ananda, of bliss. If the experience of the Atman is typically of the conscious being of the divine, the experience of the soul, finding its own truth, and then finding that same psychic truth writ large in the cosmos, because yes, there is a cosmic soul, and we are advancing towards disclosing that as we take up a cosmic yoga, each awakened individual working in commerce with all other awakening individuals. Do you see the wonder that awaits us at the end of this cosmic journey? If you're feeling tired, that vision will renew you. That wind that catches our wings and lifts us upwards carries us on the way. Great swan that you are, Paramahansa, each one of you. We'll put a bookmark there and we'll take up the rest of this first chapter on the Yoga of Divine Love next week. I thought I'd read something from Savitri to you. This is in Book 2, the Book of the Traveler of the Worlds, Canto 2, the Kingdom of Subtle Matter. I thought we'd start on page 110. You could begin anywhere. Here's a place. Thus, no, I think I'll skip a little up. The Spirit's greatness is our timeless source, and it shall be our crown in endless time. A vast unknown is round us and within. All things are wrapped in the dynamic one. A subtle link of union joins all life. Thus, all creation is a single chain. We are not left alone in a closed scheme between a driving of inconscient force and an incommunicable absolute. Our life is a spur in a sublime soul range. Our being looks beyond its walls of mind, and it communicates with greater worlds. There are brighter earths and wider heavens than ours. There are realms where being broods in its own depths. It feels in its immense dynamic core, its nameless, unformed, unborn potencies cry for expression in the unshaped vast. Ineffable beyond ignorance and death, the images of its everlasting truth look out from a chamber of its self-wrapped soul. As if to its own inner witness gaze, the Spirit holds up its mirrored self and works the power and passion of its timeless heart, the figures of its formless ecstasy, the grandeurs of its multitudinous might. Thence comes the mystic substance of our souls, into the prodigy of our nature's birth. There is the unfallen height of all we are, and dateless fount of all we hope to be. On every plane, the hieratic power, initiate of unspoken verities, dreams to transcribe and make a part of life, in its own native style and living tongue, some trait of the perfection of the unborn, some vision seen in the omniscient light, some far tone of the immortal rhapsodist voice, some rapture of the all-creating bliss, some form and plan of the beauty unutterable. Worlds are there nearer to those absolute realms where the response to truth is swift and sure, and spirit is not hampered by its frame, and hearts by sharp division seized and rent, and delight and beauty are inhabitants, and love and sweetness are the law of life. A finer substance and a subtler mold embodies the divinity earth but dreams. Its strength can overtake joy's running feet, overleaping the fixed hurdles set by time. The rapid net of an intuitive clasp captures the fugitive happiness we desire. A nature lifted by a larger breath, passive and plastic to the all-shaping fire, answers the flaming Godhead's casual touch. Immune from our inertia of response, it hears the word to which our hearts are deaf, adopts the seeing of immortal eyes, and, traveler on the roads of line and hue, pursues the spirit of beauty to its home. Thus we draw near to the all-wonderful, following his rapture in things as sign and guide. Beauty is his footprint showing us where he has passed. Love is his heartbeat's rhythm in mortal breasts. Happiness the smile on his adorable face. So the Olympics, where humanity aspires to reunite and be as one. Let us overleap the fixed hurdles set by time. Namaste, Jai Ma.